Welcome everyone to this bonus episode of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast, where we speak to interesting and knowledgeable people about how best to protect sentient beings from the harms of coming into existence. I'm your host, John, an antinatalist advocate from the UK, and I'll be the main host of the podcast going forward. As you know by now, we're using these bonus episodes to upload our talks from our December conference, AAC 23, Antinatalism at a Crossroads. We've already heard from David Pierce and Seb Alex about transhumanism and animal rights respectively in our previous episodes, and we're continuing our streak of engaging with controversial topics with a talk from renowned philosopher Matty Hyrie on antinatalism and extinction. I think this bonus episode comes at a pertinent time for AA. I received a bit of criticism over the past month for my understanding of antinatalism, which I think is totally fair. We've got more content coming out soon regarding criticisms of AA, because we think it's good to have a culture where strong but well-meaning criticism is encouraged and welcomed. And I think this talk by Matty Hyrie, where he deconstructs Lawrence's comments on antinatalism, is a perfect example of that. Let us know your thoughts in the comment section. Anyway, without further ado, I bring you this bonus episode of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast with philosopher Matty Hyrie. Enjoy.
Okay, so welcome to the next session. So hopefully everyone was able to get a bit of a break because I know there was only a couple of minutes there, but welcome to the next session. So this one is with Matty Hyrie. So this session is the last one for today, and Matty is going to be talking about antinatalism and extinction. But before we actually get on to the talk, I'm going to give a bit of an intro. But remember, if you have questions for Matty throughout the talk, then send them into the form and we will get to them near the end. So Matty is a philosopher, and he's been a, shall we say, a beacon of antinatalism in academia, in the person who first sort of formalized the risk argument for antinatalism in his 2004 paper, A Rational Cure for Pre-Reproductive Stress Syndrome. So Matty most recently has been involved in publications such as Antinatalism Solving Everything Everywhere All at Once and Imposing a Lifestyle, a New Argument for Antinatalism, and is actually the co-author for an upcoming book called Antinatalism, Extinction, and the End of Procreative Self-Corruption. So I'm really looking forward to this one, not least because I think I'm going to be getting called out for some some of the things I've been saying. So that'll be interesting to see. I'm looking forward to this one. I hope everyone is too. I'm sure everyone is too. And a reminder, if you want to ask a question, pinned message in the chat and the description, there's a form there, send them in and we will try and get to as many as possible near the end. So I think, it's over to you, Matty.
Thank you, Lawrence, for that nice introduction. I'm also a co-host of a podcast, yes, with Amanda, Falling into the Antinatal Abyss. That's enough about me for now. Let's just roll the presentation. And here we go. That's the title of my presentation. That's my academic affiliation, and that's my antinatalist t-shirt collection. My name is Matty Hyrie, and I am an antinatalist philosopher, or at least I think I am. My antinatalism to me means that I don't have children that I know of. I don't intend to have children. And I'd be pleased to see everybody acting like me in this respect. Being a philosopher to me means that I'm not an activist, and my primary aim is not to advocate antinatalism although my explications of antinatalist views may convince some others of their force. Pretty clear sailing so far, I'd say. But wait, there's more. I'm also an extinctionist philosopher, or at least I think I am. My extinctionism to me means that I'm not alarmed by the idea of not having existed in the first place. I'm not alarmed by the idea of not existing anymore, provided that my existence ends nicely, easily, and in my control, and provided that its ending doesn't unduly hurt or inconvenience those that I'm responsible for. And I would be pleased to see everybody thinking like me in this respect. Being a philosopher to me means here the same as it did in the case of antinatalism, that I'm not an activist and my primary aim is not to advocate extinctionism, although my explications of extinctionist views may convince some others of their force. I am then an extinctionist antinatalist philosopher, and I have been approximately this way for almost as long as I can remember. And I have thought that this combination of extinctionism and antinatalism is self-evident, that everybody else in our circles thinks like me. Imagine my surprise then when all of a sudden I encountered this statement by one of the organizers of this fine conference, the illustrious Lawrence Anton.
Should the extinction of humans be the or a goal of an anti-procreative movement? And if so, why? So my view on that is that I don't think it's necessary to have it as a goal. I think an anti-procreative movement should be what it says on the tin. It's anti-procreation rather than pro-extinction. Even though being anti-procreation will very likely practically lead to extinction, I think there's an important difference between being anti-procreative and pro-extinction.
And just like that, he contradicted everything I had ever believed in. The extinctionist antinatalist in me was crushed, but only for the briefest of moments. The philosopher in me came to the rescue and explained that while Lawrence has an obvious point, there are still grounds for believing that the connection, at least in an ethical sense, is quite strong. This presentation is an attempt to clarify my take on the matter. I'm starting with the observation that obviously, antinatalism is not the same as extinctionism. They are two different things. And perhaps no one claims that they are the same thing. It's more likely that the claim is normative. If you accept one, you should also accept the other. Lawrence actually makes something like this distinction by saying, even though being anti-procreation will very likely practically lead to extinction, I think there's an important difference between being anti-procreative and pro-extinction. His focus seems to be on what to promote or advocate. That is up for the conference. I'll return to this as soon as I've sorted out why I have thought what I have thought. Since it's always easier to see the mistakes others make than the mistakes one makes oneself, I might just as well start with an example. Recently, a colleague of mine, Joona Räsänen, argued in a collection that we edited together that ethical vegans must also be antinatalists. Without further specifications, I think that this is obviously wrong. I could be a vegan because I believe that humans should not use non-humans just as a means to their own human ends. And I could be an antinatalist because I believe that giving birth to children endangers women's health and well-being. Both convictions are ethical, but they are different. I can hold one without holding the other. Joona's point, however, was that an ethical vegan has to be, by his definition, a negative utilitarian. Negative utilitarians, as you all probably know, maintain that we should not by our actions increase pain or anguish in the world. Food production increases pain and anguish among non-human animals, and veganism is therefore the right choice. But bringing more sentient beings into existence also increases pain and anguish in the world. that had they not been in the first place, the suffering they encounter would not have occurred. It would be better then not to have them, and antinatalism is also the right choice, and for the same reason veganism is right. The conclusion here is, of course, more limited than the one originally suggested. It is, those who are vegans on negative utilitarian grounds should probably also be antinatalists on negative utilitarian grounds. Why am I bringing this up? Well, the case reminds me of my own theoretical origins. See, during the last 2 millennia, my thinking has evolved in these steps. Utilitarianism, the traditional version, measure the good and the bad outcomes of your action alternatives and choose the one that on balance maximizes the net good or minimizes the net bad. Negative utilitarianism, forget about the good and concentrate on the bad. Don't choose an action alternative that promotes suffering. Extinctionism. Admit that as long as there are sufferers, there is suffering. Remove sentient beings from the equation and stop the suffering. Antinatalism. Realize that all other ways of removing sentient beings from the equation will probably just promote more suffering, and that the kindest way to proceed is to stop reproduction. These steps in my thinking are partly, but only partly, well documented. Utilitarianism, yes, clearly in my 1994 book Liberal Utilitarianism and Applied Ethics. I flirted with negative utilitarianism, but the idea of human extinction was so unpopular that I retreated to a more traditional version. Negative utilitarianism, yes, but in its full form only earlier this year in my article Exit Duty Generator. It was budding already in my 1995 paper, Is It Undesirable That Children Are Born Infected with HIV? But that was published only in Italian years later and went unnoticed. Extinctionism. Yes and no. I know the exact date in November 1998 when talking about the human predicament and the big red button with my then partner in Cowbridge, Wales, I realized that I am a voluntary human extinctionist. I must have preached a good message to everybody after that, because although I never properly publicized the view, many academic friends are on record during the noughties criticizing the hell out of my newly found inhumanity. Antinatalism. Yes, but sort of unbeknownst to me for a long time. In 2004, I published a short article titled A Rational Cure for Pre-Reproductive Stress Syndrome. I argued that having children is irrational and immoral. It took 12 years, however, before I found out that I had, in that paper, presented what some call the original formulation of the risk argument for antinatalism. Oh well. And finally, I get to the point of this lengthy exposition of my personal intellectual history. I was an extinctionist first, and antinatalism for me has, up to this day, been just a gentle route towards the voluntary demise of humankind. Hence my surprise when I saw Lawrence's declaration. But to summarize, he's spot on. Antinatalism and extinctionism are two different beasts, held together in my head only by the negative utilitarian ethos underlying both. Taking on board my own criticism of Joona's insistence that vegans have to be antinatalists, I must admit that there are different reasons for being one or the other, also in the case of extinctionism and antinatalism. Amanda Sukenik and I listed some of the motives behind people's aversion to having children in our forthcoming book, Antinatalism, Extinction, and the End of Procreative Self-Corruption. The list is partly jocular, but Amanda assures me that this is the landscape we must enter if any dream of antinatalist advocacy is to come true. This is what we came up with.
Population growth degrades the natural environment. The world is a bad place and should not be populated more. Reproduction requires sex, and sex is a sin. Our children's lives would be bad. We do not have their permission to bring them into existence. Life is suffering, and we should not contribute to its continuation. Children are a burden. Children are a nuisance. Men are evil. Women are evil. Human beings are evil. Humankind inflicts suffering on other species. My life sucks. I wish I were dead. I wish I had never been born. My life has no meaning. Human life has no meaning. Life has no meaning.
The list can go on. It is, to say the least, a mixed bag. You may agree or disagree, or maybe your pet reason is not included, but one thing is clear. Most of these are real-life motivations for being an antinatalist, and not all of them have anything to do with extinction. Extinction of some kind is, however, an inevitable consequence of consistent antinatalism. If no one has children anymore, humankind will meet its demise within a century or so. If that sounds too sudden, there are alternatives, of course. If every reproductive couple only has one child, and if they all have the one child in their early 30s, we get from the current 8 billion human beings to zero in about 33 generations, or 1100 years. Some people, notably David Pierce, who is with us today, say that humankind will never assume reproductive policies like these. Therefore, they continue, we should aim to reduce suffering and to increase happiness by other methods, technology, medicine, genetics, and the like. If all suffering could indeed be eliminated by technological means, negative utilitarians should have no ethical complaints. I have a conceptual complaint, though. If humankind continues to reproduce without a time limit, in what sense are we talking about antinatalism here? David Pierce has called himself a soft antinatalist because he has no children and no wish to have them. He can, of course, use that name as long as we keep one thing in mind. It is that his personal choice has no necessary connection with his views on technology and the hedonistic imperative, exquisite creations that they are. Negative utilitarianism, or utilitarianism more generally, could dictate both, but living happily ever after is not antinatalism. Nor is voluntary childlessness without a universal dimension, like my "I'd be pleased to see everybody acting like me." It's just what it says, or should say, on the tin. Voluntary childlessness. Admirable, but no immediate antinatalist cigar that I can see. Vocabulary aside, however, the very real question raised here is more general. Is it at all realistic to think that humankind would ever stop reproducing? Is all this just chasing shadows? Two answers offer themselves, a historical one and a normative one. What I say here is based on my investigations and analyses with Amanda Sukenik for our publications. The historical response is that it's early days yet. Human beings want to have sex, and sex has been inexorably linked with reproduction throughout history. The link is gradually breaking, at least in the global north. Contraception and reproductive autonomy are already at work. I know that most of you, most of us, want the change to happen now, or preferably yesterday, but if that's not realistic, maybe the acceptance of a slower pace would be advisable. Continue knowing the foundations of pronatalism in the sure and certain hope of better times ahead, maybe. Normative response is to turn inwards a little, away from the world embracing concerns of utilitarianism and related consequentialist views. I can at least retain my own purity in this matter and let other people know about my reasons. Perhaps some of them will follow suit. And whatever others do, I'm not chasing shadows here. My decision not to reproduce prevents the coming to existence of at least one line of sufferers. Good for me, good for them. There. It has been demonstrated that some humans can stop having offspring. Not enough, but it's a start. All this has been explained in more detail in Antinatalism, Extinction, and the End of Procreative Self-Corruption, which will be available soon online, open access. When that one inevitably goes viral and the airport sales of the hard copies start producing millions and millions, Amanda and I should perhaps start a pension fund for antinatalists. Isn't that what concerns the pronatalists? Who will look after them in their old age? We'd have our own solution here. But I stray. This was supposed to be about extinction. What was my point? Well, an interim conclusion and a three-prong corollary. Antinatalism proper, consistent antinatalism, leads to voluntary human extinction. If negative utilitarianism or something similar is evoked, other varieties of extinction can come to play. If a sentiocentric theory of value is used, maybe all sentient life should be wiped out in the name of eliminating suffering. If a reversely biocentric theory of value is used, maybe all life should be wiped out, perhaps because life finds a way to become sentient. And if the analysis is not confined to carbon-based life, maybe machine sentience, self-awareness, and so on should not be developed. Analyzing concepts and theories I have assumed so far doesn't necessarily mean advocating the related views. But this is a fine line. Let me explain what I mean. You may be surprised to hear this, but Amanda and I wrote our forthcoming book Under Constraint. Our supervising production editor at Cambridge University Press made it clear to us in no uncertain terms that there is to be no advocacy of antinatalism in the text. Now, this is highly unusual and probably breaks a couple of the laws of the game in passing. Academics publish papers for and against the right to abortion, euthanasia, infertility treatments, and universal healthcare provision all the time, and there is normally no censorship. One person says one thing, the other says another, and the debate goes on unrestrained. Except that reproduction may be another kettle of fish. I know from my own experience that if you want to defend the right to abortion, the safest tactic is to frame it in terms of reproductive autonomy. Women are entitled to choose when and with whom they have children. The default value remains that they will, if they can, eventually have children. Arguments from the low quality of the possible future life meet stronger opposition. Critics are quick to point out that if fetuses can be killed based on bad life prospects, then the same could be applied to infants. And in the bigger picture, the threat of human extinction looms large. If people have bad lives, why don't we just kill them all? As you can imagine, I'm trying to hold back my inner extinctionist with both hands here. Why don't we indeed? Why not end it all? Preparing this presentation brought back a memory from nearly 30 years ago. I mentioned earlier the 1995 paper, Is It Undesirable That Children Are Born Infected with HIV? The original title was, Is It Intolerable That Children Are Born Infected with HIV? Women with HIV considered carrying their pregnancies to term with a 50-50 chance that the child will be infected during the delivery. The medication was not developed yet, and the infection would have meant for the child a very short and miserable life, leading to an excruciating death in a few months. I thought that this kind of a gamble would be intolerable and said so. The audience in Prague, doctors, nurses, and priests, would have none of that. But the treatments are developing all the time, they said. Injections might reduce the risk, they said. Having a child would be the fulfillment of the dying woman's life, they said. How dare I deny her that? And 50-50 are pretty good odds, considering what is at stake, they said. I left the conference, ears burning, promising myself that I will never touch topics like this again. As an aside, meanwhile in Germany, another budding academic drew different conclusions. Karim Akerma, a much more pronounced antinatalist than I was at the time, went on with his agenda, with, if I have understood correctly, devastating consequences to his academic career. Unspeakably sad. At the same time, the 1990s, Peter Singer, whose name you may know, was also under attack in Germany. He was seen to advocate the view that since non-human animals can be used in scientific experiments, people with low mental capacities could be used in them as well. As I interpreted the argument, his point was quite the opposite. Since we are reluctant to use humans, however low their mental capacities in scientific experiments, we should be equally reluctant to use non-humans in them. Be that as it may, Peter came under heavy fire, and even the word bioethics was practically banned in Germany for a while because it was associated with his work. In the United States, bioethics was already a thriving discipline, and Europe followed suit during the next decade or so. Anyway, I began this particular story by telling that Amanda and I were under censorship during the writing of our book. No advocacy, no activism, or there will be no book. Our official response was to say what the editor wanted to hear. There will be no advocacy whatsoever, full stop. Cross our hearts and hope to die. We then went on to write an adamant historical critique of European moral philosophy, claiming that it's nothing but a long series of attempts to curb antinatalism, the only proper response to life's cosmic futility. We followed that up with a bold conceptual account of all sorts of extinction and concluded that consistent antinatalists must at least be amenable to the demise of humankind, maybe other species as well. And we rounded off the proceedings by presenting a fierce normative defense of antinatalism, complete with instructions to practical antinatalists on how to promote the cause. The magic here is in the relentless repetition of the words historical, conceptual, and normative, accompanied by constant reminders that this is a philosophical analysis, not a manual. Smoke and mirrors. But I still haven't answered Lawrence's reasonable question. Why involve extinctionism in the first place? Can we not just advocate pure antinatalism without talking about the demise of species? Long story short, yes, we can, but it comes with a price. Consistent antinatalism does lead to extinction, and that is undeniable. Inconsistent or conditional or temporary or soft antinatalism doesn't, but selective pronatalism is a better name for that. We can, however, at least to some degree save Lawrence's day by resorting to mental reservations. At least two alternatives offer themselves. According to the doctrine of double effect favored by Roman Catholic philosophers, we are allowed to separate the good and the bad outcomes of our actions in a manner that could be useful here. To cite Amanda and myself.
According to the Neo-Thomist doctrine of double effect, an act that has two outcomes, a good one and a bad one, is permissible if four conditions are met. One, the act is in and of itself morally good or at least neutral. Two, the bad outcome is not directly willed or intended. Three, the good outcome is not a consequence of the bad outcome. Four, the good outcome is proportionate to the bad outcome. An example of a morally permissible act would be rescuing people from a burning house, even at the cost of breaking arms and legs in the process. This is because, one, rescuing people is good. 2, the rescuer would avoid doing the damage if it were possible. 3, the broken limbs do not cause the survival of the rescued. And 4, saving lives at the cost of inflicting reparable harm is proportionate. Could the doctrine be applied to the case of antinatalism and extinction as well?
You can find our full answer in the book, but one thing stands out. The third condition, that we are not allowed to do evil to achieve good, might well be the motivation behind Lawrence's plea. The point would then be that extinction by antinatalism can be at least endurable, while antinatalism by extinction, say by the big red button, cannot. For an extinctionist, this doesn't make any sense, but whatever. The second mental reservation model can be derived from Immanuel Kant's famous moral philosophy and the Argentinian-Brazilian antinatalist Julio Cabrera has in fact suggested something like it. According to Cabrera, we have a duty not to have children because both procreation and education involve manipulation that cannot be accepted. This idea can be combined with the Kantian notion of duties dictated by the moral law. Fulfilling these duties may, Kant conceded, sometimes lead to really bad consequences. Lying, always forbidden by the moral law, is forbidden even if we could save a life by straying from the truth. A murderer asks whether the intended victim is upstairs, and you have a duty not to lie. Similarly, we may have a moral duty not to have children, although we know that not having children, if observed universally, leads to human extinction. Even if human extinction is seen to be evil, the duty stands. And this is how a non-extinctionist antinatalist can justify the view that only anti-procreation is intended. The rest is just collateral damage. The more general message here could be that merely looking at the outcomes, suffering and misery, may have to be complemented by some rule-based thinking to get the antinatalist message through more widely. Also, you can put a sordino on extinction talk as long as you remember that by advocating antinatalism consistently, you also promote, however indirectly, the eventual demise of at least our species. Thank you.
The first question I want to kick off with, and this is more just to, because I know there was a lot of information in there, so this is more just to get a sort of encapsulated answer for people at the back of the class who maybe weren't, you know, keeping up with everything. Is so, in your opinion, can antinatalism legitimately be separated from pro-extinctionism?
Well, yes, that would depend on the definition of antinatalism, because if it means consistent non-reproduction, no children whatsoever, then extinction has to be accepted either as an intended consequence, something that we mean, or at least as a foreseen side effect, something that we don't mean but will happen anyway. Of course, if antinatalism just means having less children, then extinction doesn't come into this picture at all. But it's just that I personally fail to see why antinatalism would be defined as having less children when we can define it by as having no children.
Mm. Yeah, no, thank you for that. So my first proper question that I wanted to like dig into is, so the ethics of extinction seem to change depending on the moral status, should we put it, of the beings whose extinction we're considering. So in theory, human extinction can occur entirely voluntarily. You know, just everyone just throws up their hands and, you know, we sort of fade into the abyss as no one procreates. But in your upcoming book, you deal with the topic of non-human animals or even aliens and their extinction. How do the ethics of extinction change between the circumstances where the beings in question are moral agents deciding for themselves to become extinct and where moral agents are deciding on behalf of other non-moral agents for them to go extinct. How do those two things differ, and how do they change the ethics of extinction?
Okay, that's a very good question. Do we have 2 hours? I think that I need about that to answer this one. Well, anyways, it's a good question. And it's really easy to answer if your moral theory is traditional negative utilitarianism, because if it is, then you have a duty not to eliminate suffering, both that of your own species and that of other species. So extinction all around, no problem. Agency and autonomy, the things that you mentioned, they are not a part of this puzzle at all. But if your moral theory is something else, it's a different matter. And I have myself struggled with this for years and years and years. So for me, it's kind of clear that factory farming should be stopped. Although this would mean, although this would mean that some human bred non-human species would go extinct, I seem to be okay with that. And I was thinking about that. Why do I think like that? And it's maybe that I'm thinking that factory farm animals are somehow in our care. We have duties to them. This special relationship that we have with them produces for us a duty to end their suffering. So it's not so much that we are entitled, that we have a right to choose for these fellow beings, as it is that we have a duty. We are duty bound to do so because they are there because of us, something like that.
So when it comes to, so you obviously are in favor of voluntary human extinction, but not the extinction of wild animals. Where does the difference in your positions on these two groups come from?
Okay, an easy answer and a difficult one. Voluntary human extinction for me is just a simple consequence of my antinatalism. I mean, if my antinatalism means that I don't have children, I don't intend to have children, and I'd be fine with everybody else doing the same. And if everybody stops having children, then eventually there will be no human beings. And then we have all decided that, and nothing controversial about that for me. I don't really believe that there is any value in humankind's continued existence if we collectively, every one of us, have decided that there is none. Other people have other views on this one. And that was the easy one. Then the difficult one, the animals in the wild, I don't know. We can't ask them. And they are not in our custody like factory farm animals are. The explanation that I just made up and inserted into my previous answer. And now I don't know. I can only report my thinking here. I think that they may have some life force of their own that we cannot understand and that we should respect. An analogical case for autonomy. I'm all for human autonomy. I'm not killing humankind without everybody's permission here. Well, I might, but that's the other thing. But anyway, if people choose to go extinct, that's their choice, our choice. But is it the choice of chimpanzees, or is it the choice of whales or butterflies or antelopes or lions or worms? And I don't know. And this is why I'm more cautious about that. Having said that, of course, as far as I know, life in the wild is pretty miserable. And maybe it would be just the kindest thing to stop all their suffering too. But sort of I'm explaining to myself that I don't have to make this choice to be an antinatalist in human matters, because only straightforward negative utilitarians have that problem. And as far as I know, I'm not a straightforward negative utilitarian. I may be a confused negative utilitarian, but I'm not a straightforward.
So you mentioned in your talk, David Pearson, a sort of transhumanist answer to the sort of pessimistic evaluation of life. Why, in a sort of nutshell, why are you opposed to the transhumanist approach of removing suffering from sentient experience and pursuing a future of species that way?
The removal of suffering would be obviously a good thing, but it's just that there are, in my axiology, in my theory of value, there are other good things, like ending manipulation between humans, so manipulation from human to human. And my example in our context is just that reproducers have children, and then to justify their choice after the fact, they have to tell their children to have children of their own as well, because if they tell them not to have children, then children will ask them, mommy, daddy, well, am I unwanted then? Or, and then it just goes on. And then you have to explain your children that you have to have children, and on it goes, the imposition of the reproductive lifestyle, the imposition of the reproductive breeder's mentality. So even if physical pain, this is to answer your transhumanist removing pain thing, even if physical pain in some simple form could be removed from human lives, then there's the possibility, and I think probability, that frustration and anguish about unequal power relations would still continue, and the world without the ouch effect would not be a paradise, happiness machine or no happiness machine, something like that.
Yeah, and you know, you were kind enough to send me over some material of your upcoming book, and in it you talk about how you sort of view transhumanism as a sort of, you know, tech optimism and naivety, and I wanted to ask you, do you think that placing the emphasis of the answer to the, you know, the pessimistic value of life on voluntary human extinction is also liable to the same accusation of optimism and naivety when it comes to how plausible it actually is to expect to achieve this? To you know, because voluntary human extinction is,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, first of all, I do think that transhumanism is a bit naive, but that's just my experience. I've been in this racket for 40 years, and transhumanism, that particular kind, has been around for that 40 years, and I don't see any real development. I know that David Pierce said in a few hundred years, but then that's an awfully long time, and I don't see anything happening. We have more and more gadgets. We may yet fly to the Mars, but I see misery just increasing in the world. So your question then is that if I'm thinking that that's naive, transhumanism is naive, and I think, then would it be naive to think that people stop reproducing as well? Yes, absolutely. That's another thing. So suffering will not be eliminated in our lifetime. Reproduction will not stop in our lifetime. These are wishful thinking. But there is, I think, an important difference in that one is doing a good thing and the other is not. Transhumanism relies, at least in all its current forms that I know of, it relies on perpetual growth, so economic growth, material growth, and that is only making things worse on our limited planet, our planet with some ecological boundaries. And now antinatalism, as far as I can see, is offering the opposite, degrowth, or if that's too thick a concept, then something a little bit of toning down. So anyone joining the antinatalist quest is already a virtuous person, breaking their own omelas, not creating their own omelas, child and what have you, eliminating at least one family line of suffering. But transhumanists, I don't want to accuse anyone, but it's just possible that they are just perpetuating the lifestyle of suffering.
And in again, in your upcoming book, you mentioned the sort of famous, infamous red button thought experiment. Can you, just for anyone in the audience who may not be familiar, can you explain what that thought experiment is, and whether you think it's actually useful in discussions about antinatalism?
Sure, yes. First of all, I think that most people here know what the big red button is. It's an imaginary device for ending all life or all sentient life, or making the whole universe disappear, depending on your definition. It's just you only have to press the button and everything is gone. Is it useful? Well, it's useful for testing your intuitions about extinction, I think. If you think you could or should press it, then you are an extinctionist. You don't then hold human life or sentient life or life in general in any particular awe. And then most people are likely to think that you are a nihilist, cynic, pessimist, and an all-round horrible person. That's at least the reaction that I get. And then I smile a lot and they get confused. When I'm being interviewed for antinatalist media, the hosts always want to know what my personal take on the big red button is. Could I press it? Would I press it? Should I press it? And I have different answers to these all. I could. Down there, gone. I probably would, but I couldn't tell anyone beforehand because it's, well, I'll explain that in a bit. But for should I am in absolutely in two minds about this. The idea of removing all suffering is tempting. Tom, God. But then what about my grand talk about autonomy and life force and whatever Elan Vital I've just mentioned? What happened to those? I don't know. I'm thinking that luckily I don't need to know, because the big red button is a thought experiment. I'm stressing that it's a thought experiment, not to be confused with reality in any way. And this is why I probably wouldn't and couldn't tell anyone. Because if someone started building a real life device like that, I fear that it would just end up in tears. People are by and large idiots. And the result would be a nuclear holocaust or something worse. Some life would be wiped out, the rest would be remaining in even more horrible conditions. But your question was, is it a useful tool for in discussions on antinatalism? Well, it's not an antinatalist tool as such. It's an extinctionist tool. As I see it, it can only serve to reinforce the distinction that you have made between the two isms. It's all about the order of things. You can, like yourself, say that extinction by antinatalism, by not having children, would be all right. So if you do it in that order, but then you can still say that antinatalism by extinction, that you stop having children by potom, you can still say that there's something wrong with that. So that's fair enough. You're right.
And so I've
talked half an hour for nothing.
So I've got one more prepared question, and then we'll go on to audience questions. We might only have time for one or two. But so my last question is, so again, in your upcoming book, you speak about anti-AI natalism. So the opposition to the creation of artificial sentience that, you know, may or may not be, you know, possible, which, you know, was discussed with David Pearce earlier. So you also speak about a thought experiment by Thomas Metzinger known as the BARN, Benevolent Artificial Antinatalism Thought Experiment. So in this thought experiment, Thomas basically asks us to imagine that a super clever and super compassionate machine could come to understand that humans suffer, but humans are also too biased towards extinction, towards existence, to escape their condition themselves. And so the machine could facilitate an ethical extinction. How do you think about, or how do you think antinatalists should view the creation of artificial sentience, given this, bearing this thought experiment in mind?
Yes, I think I see two different questions here. One, the creation of artificial sentience, and two, Metzinger's idea. So in that order, artificial sentience first. I think it's a very, very bad idea, because we already have beings capable of suffering here with all the organic life that we have around. And now someone would like to develop machines that can suffer, which is utter nonsense and unkind to the greatest possible degree, especially thinking that then if this is machines, then it goes to mass production. And that means that we have millions, we have billions of new sufferers by that method. So come on, have a heart, have a brain. Mm. No, don't do it. So that was my take on developing deliberately sentient artificial intelligence. Metzinger's scenario, on the other hand, that gives me great hope. I mean, oh, fantastic. If only that were. We touch upon that with Amanda Sukenik in our book under the heading of Cunning of Reason. Now, people may not know what that means, so I'll just briefly say that the German Enlightenment philosopher Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel had this idea of things happening sort of in this world on their own weight, without any human being deliberately doing. It's not about people's intentions. It's just happening historically. Ideas are developing by themselves, one contradicting the other, and then reaching a higher level together. Now, maybe, just maybe, this is already happening in a world of technology, and we just haven't realized it yet. I mean, as we well know from the Terminator saga, the big machine in there, the Skynet, already became self-aware on August the 29th, 1997. So artificial intelligence has had ample time to develop, to hone the wisdom and compassion that Metzinger is talking about. So perhaps it is, perhaps Skynet or whatever is preparing to pull the plug as we speak. That would be a very welcome turn of events.
Mm. So now I'm going to go on to we maybe only have time for one audience question. We'll see how it goes. But so this question. So other than voluntary peaceful human extinction through non-procreation, are there other means of achieving extinction that you'd find acceptable?
Are there any other ways of going towards not having children and perhaps going extinct?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. That you would find acceptable, or do you reject all others?
There are many ways. I think that Amanda and I are at the end of our book, the book that wasn't supposed to have any advocacy in it. I think that we are advocating 12 to 13 different solutions, starting with the big red button, then going on to the big blue button, which is that you take the reproductive capacity of people, and the big yellow button, which was something, I don't remember what that one was. Then we had the big green button, which is the abolitionist thing, where the lion lies with the lamb. In the end, human beings become perhaps softer or go away, and then all the other animals, non-humans, live in peace, and so on and so forth. And then there is the barn that the technology, the cunning of reason, is already doing it, and then there are many other things. They are more lunatic than the next one is always more lunatic than the previous one. So there is no if the question was there any sensible way of getting there. Well, I don't know. That's why I'm saying, I said in my presentation and said now, that perhaps this is not about the consequences. Perhaps we shouldn't be just talking about the end result here. We should perhaps be more thinking about our own self-corruption, and thinking that once I don't breed, then at least that's me covered.
Yeah, and you know, obviously there can be debates around which one of those, or if any of them, are sensible. But other than complete voluntary human extinction, are there any that you personally think would be acceptable to pursue?
I can't say anything about that, because if I really had the big red button, which is a thought experiment, so I don't have it, I would press it. But other than that, I don't see any other way than saying, I don't have children, I don't intend to have children. Mm-hmm. It would be nice if you followed suit in this one. And then one person gets persuaded, the other person gets persuaded, perhaps everybody gets persuaded. And then I'm not holding my breath, because then somebody comes along and we have all the Brave New World and 1984 scenarios, and then we have a noble wild who is procreating, and then we are, by the laws of drama, we are drawn to that idiot.
But either way, I think, you know, both you, myself, and probably everyone watching puts a big emphasis on autonomy and respecting autonomy. Cool. So I think we're not going to have time for another audience question, just because we've already run over by 6 minutes. But thank you, everyone who did submit questions. And thank you, Matti, for, you know, coming on and being part of the first day of the conference and doing this session. We're going to move over into a closing, just a short closing remarks now. So I just wanted to say thank you again to Matti and see everyone.
Thank you very much, Lawrence. It's been a pleasure. It's been an honor. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Matti.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. We'd also be really grateful if you could help us get the word out there by sharing this episode far and wide, as well as giving us a positive rating on whichever platform you're listening to us on. To find out more about AA, including careers advice, donation recommendations, and different ways to have a positive impact, you can go to our website at antinatalistadvocacy.org. To keep up to date with what we're up to, feel free to subscribe to our monthly newsletter and follow us on your favourite social media platforms. Links to all of the above are in the description. As always, we are hoping you will join us in our antinatalist advocacy.